And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, I don't usually air issues on this show. But I'm going to make an exception today. You see all these commercials about Liberty Mutual all over the TV. What wonderful things they do for their customers. They don't like the minorities, especially they don't like Jews. They don't like disabled veterans. We had an adjuster. We had a roof issue. And he was actually one of those that recommended the roofers. They're going to do such a wonderful job for us. The roof leaked like a sieve after getting everything they could out of the insurance company. Then they wanted me to turn over my veterans benefits to them because they were entitled. That's free VA money. So we finally, after 8 years, managed to get a new roof put on the house. And I filed, it was recommended, a claim with the insurance company. Since the first roof wasn't even put on correctly, put on backward. Actually, I don't know how you do that. And, I mean, some of the things that the inspection report showed made it clear they weren't even trying to do it right. So I talked to the adjuster, who said, well, we've decided to close your claim, without talking to me, of course, and reopen the original claim, which never should have been closed because we didn't approve anything. The adjuster at the time literally adopted the roofing company. Apparently, he had some kind of fraternity relationship with one of the roofing people that owned the company. And copied them on every document about me at the insurance company. He knew our mortgage company. The roofers knew our mortgage company. Knew everything about the programs I had available to me through the VA. And they wanted it. They were entitled to it. By God, they were going to have it. And when I complained to the adjuster, he said, well, I have to protect the roofers from you people. People like you, meaning, in his mind, Jews, because my wife is Jewish, makes no bones about it. I don't address race, and of course it's assumed I'm Jewish as well. People like you have all this money and you should be sharing. And they brought in a jackleg law firm out of either San Antonio or Austin who literally seduced the judge. I don't know any other way to put it. Even though a court decided the roof didn't even meet local code, that's okay because people like us have all this money and ought to be sharing it with the roofers. It's been the craziest thing I've ever seen in my life. But, you know, doesn't matter. I should be willing to share what I have with these roofers because, after all, you know, people like us. I'd still get incensed when I hear that phrase. Well, today is March the 16th. Oh, and also, Russia has now said we should turn over Alaska and pay reparations for all the harm we've caused them. And the thing that I'm concerned about is our illustrious commander-in-chief who thinks Kamala Harris is the first lady might well do it. March 16th, 75th day of the year. 290 days remain till the year's over with. Well, on this day in 934... Ming Xiang declares himself emperor and establishes later Shu as a new state independent of later Tang. 1190, massacre of Jews at Clifford's Tower in York. 1244, over 200 Cathars who refused to recant burned to death after the fall of Montsegur. That was when the Pope had a crusade against non-Catholics in Europe. 1621, Samoset, a Mohegan, visits a settler of Plymouth calling, greets him, welcome, as an Englishman, my name is Samoset. 1660, the Long Parliament of England is dissolved, so it's prepared for the new Convention Parliament. 1792, King Gustav III of Sweden is shot and dies March 29th. 1802, the Army Corps of Engineers is established to found and operate the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, where a lot of the cadets apparently enjoy getting high. 1815, Prince William proclaims himself King of the United Kingdom of the Netherlands, the first constitutional monarch in the Netherlands. 1872, the Wanderers FC won the first FA Cup, the oldest football competition in the world, beating the Royal Engineers AFC 1-0 at the Oval in Kennington in London. 1898, in Melbourne, the representatives of the five colonies adopt a constitution that will become the basis of the Commonwealth of Australia. 1916, the 7th and 10th U.S. Cavalry Regiments under John Pershing cross the U.S.-Mexico border to join the hunt for Pancho Villa. And as I said yesterday, I had a gentleman who was on that little excursion. He was, the term used was, he was the Batman for Pershing, kind of a enlisted servant. Said that the whole thing was a game, so to speak. In the evening, Villa and his senior staffers would come down from the hills and they'd play cards with Pershing and his staffers until dawn. Pershing and Pancho Villa were good friends. Not very many people knew that, and Pershing, who everybody thought commanded Fort Bliss, did not. 1918, the Finnish Civil War, Battle of Länkipohja, is infamous for its bloody aftermath as the whites executed 70 to 100 capitulated Reds. 1924, in accordance with the Treaty of Rome, Fiume becomes annexed as part of Italy. 1926, history of rocketry. Robert Goddard launches the first liquid fuel rocket at Auburn, Massachusetts. 1935, Adolf Hitler orders Germany to rearm herself in violation of the Treaty of Versailles. Conscription is reintroduced to form the Wehrmacht. 1936, warmer than normal temperatures rapidly melt snow and ice on the upper Allegheny and the Monongahela rivers, leading to a major flooding in Pittsburgh. 1939, from Prague Castle, Hitler proclaims Bohemia and Moravia German protectorates. 1945, World War II, the Battle of Iwo Jima ended. Small pockets of Japanese resistance continued, though. 1945, 90% of Würzburg, Germany is destroyed in only 20 minutes by British bombers, resulting in about 4,000 deaths. 1962, Flying Tiger Line Flight 739 disappears in the Western Pacific Ocean. All 107 on board are missing and presumed dead. 1966, the launch of Gemini 8 with astronauts Neil Armstrong and David Scott takes place on this date, performing the first docking of two spacecraft in orbit. 1968, Vietnam War. My Lai Massacre occurs. Between 347 and 500 Vietnamese villagers are killed by American troops. 1969, the Viasa McDonnell Douglas DC-9 crashes in Maracaibo, Venezuela, kills 155. 1977, the assassination of Kamal Jumblatt, the main leader of the anti-government forces in the Lebanese Civil War, takes place on this date. 1978, former Italian Prime Minister Aldo Moro is kidnapped. His captors later murder him. 1978, a Balkan Bulgarian Airlines Tupolev Tu-134 crashes near Gabare, Bulgaria, killing 73. 1978, supertanker Amoco Cadiz splits in two after running aground on the Port Sal Rocks 3 miles off the coast of Brittany, results in the largest oil spill in history at that time. 1979, Sino-Vietnamese War. People's Liberation Army crosses the border back into China, which ends the war. 1984, William Buckley, the CIA station chief in Lebanon, is kidnapped by Hezbollah, dies in captivity. 1985, Associated Press newsman Terry Anderson is taken hostage in Beirut. He's not released until December 1991. 1988, the Nine-Contra War. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, who I knew, and Vice Admiral John Poindexter indicted on charges of conspiracy to defraud the U.S. Of course, we're not going to talk about insider trading by members of the Congress. 1988, Al-Baha chemical attack. The Kurdish town of Al-Baha in Iraq is attacked with a mix of poison gas and nerve agents on the orders of Saddam Hussein. Kills 5,000 and injures about 10,000 more. 1988, the Troubles. Ulster loyalist militant Michael Stone attacks a provisional IRA funeral in Belfast with pistols and grenades. Three people, one of them a member of the provisional IRA, are killed. More than 60 others are wounded. 1995, Mississippi formally ratifies the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Becomes the last state in the Union to approve the abolition of slavery. 13th Amendment was formally, officially ratified in 1865. 2001, a series of bomb blasts in the city of Shijiazhuang, China, kills 108 and injures 38 more, the biggest mass murder in China in decades. 2003, American activist Rachel Corrie is killed in Rafah by being run over by Israel Defense Forces bulldozer while trying to obstruct the demolition of a home. Well, if you're dumb enough to get in front of a bulldozer. 2005, Israel officially hands over Jericho to Palestinian control. 2014, Crimea votes on a controversial referendum to secede from Ukraine to join Russia. 2016, a bomb detonates in a bus carrying government employees in Peshawar, Pakistan. Kills 15, injures at least 30 more. 2016, two suicide bombers detonate their explosives at a mosque during morning prayer on the outskirts of Maiduguri in Nigeria. Kills 24, injures 18 more. 2020, the Dow Jones Industrial Average falls by 2,997.10, the single largest point drop in history and second largest percentage drop ever at 12.93%, even greater crash than Black Monday in 1929. This follows U.S. Federal Reserve announcing it will cut its target interest rates to 0 to 0.25%. 2021, Atlanta spa shootings. 8 people are killed. One's injured in a trio of shootings at spas in or near Atlanta, Georgia. Suspects arrested on the same day. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Christian feast day. Aban, Finian Lobhar, Finian the leper, Heribert of Cologne, Hilarius of Aquileia, Julian of Antioch, Day of the Book Smugglers in Lithuania, Remembrance Day of the Latvian Legionnaires in Latvia, and St. Urho's Day, celebrated by Finnish Americans and Finnish Canadians. Well, a lot of births and deaths on this date in history, far too many to even talk about. The 597 BC, Babylonians captured Jerusalem, replace Jerioshan with Zedekiah as a king. 1079, Iran adopts the solar Hiram calendar. 1190, the York program, Jews living in York, England, besieged in Clifford's Tower, are massacred to commit suicide rather than submit to baptism. 1249, the Servite order is officially approved by Cardinal Raniero Capossi, Papal Legate in Tuscany. 1322, the Battle of Vero Bridge takes place in the First War of Scottish Independence. 1345, Holy Spirit glides above the fire. The Miracle of Amsterdam, which is a legend that comes from that date. 1517, Pope Leo X signs the Fifth Council of Lateranum. 1527, Battle of Kanua. Mughal Emperor Babur defeats Rajput forces led by Rana Sanga, consolidating Mughal power. 1641, General Court declares Rai a democracy and adopts a new constitution. Rai, Rhode Island. 1660, English and Long Parliament disbands. Can't read my own handwriting. 1689, a 23rd Regiment of Foot of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers is founded. In 2004, it merged with the Royal Regiment of Wales to form the Royal Welsh Regiment. 1690, French King Louis XIV, the Sun King, sends troops to Ireland. 1730, Wilhelm Charles Henry Friso installed as Viceroy of Madrid. 1731, Treaty of Vienna, signed by Prince Eugene of Savoy, Count Sinzendorf, and Count Gundacker. Thomas Stahremberg and the British envoy to Vienna, Sir Thomas Robinson. 1802, the Army Corps of Engineers is established on this date for the second time. 1802, the first U.S. Military Academy at West Point is established through Congressional Act. It opens July 4th, 1802. 1818, the Second Battle of Concha Reata. Spanish forces defeat the Chileans under José de San Martín. 1827, the first U.S. newspaper called Freedom's Journal that was owned and operated by African Americans began publishing in New York City. 1829, Ohio authorizes high school night classes. 1830, London's reorganized police force begins operations. It's called Scotland Yard. 1830, New York Stock Exchange had its slowest day ever on this date. 31 shares traded. 1836, the Constitution of the Republic of Texas is approved on this date, legalizes slavery. 1861, Arizona Territory votes to leave the Union in the U.S. Civil War. 1861 also, Confederate government appoints commissioners to Britain. 1861, Edward Clark becomes governor of Texas. He replaced Texas Revolutionary Sam Houston, who's evicted from office for refusing to take an oath of loyalty to the Confederacy. 1865, the Battle of Averysboro, North Carolina. There are 1,500 casualties. On this day in 1867 is the first publication of an article by Joseph Lister outlining the discovery of antiseptic surgery. It was published in The Lancet. 1869, Minister and U.S. Senator Hiram Revels makes the first official speech by an African American in the Senate. 1875, English FA Cup final replay, Kennington Oval, London, Royal Engineers, beat Old Estonians 2-0 after the initial 1-1 draw. 1876, Nellie Saunders and Rose Harlan meet in the first female boxing match in New York. 1882, the U.S. Senate ratifies the Geneva Convention of 1864, legitimizing the International Red Cross and the American Red Cross. 1883, on this date, Susan Hayhurst becomes the first U.S. woman graduate of a pharmacy college. 1900, Sir Arthur Evans rediscovers the Bronze Age city of Knossos in Crete, home of the legendary Minotaur. 1910, Barney Oldfield uses a Benz to break the existing records at Daytona Beach Road Course. He hit 131.25 miles per hour. Unbelievable. 1912, American First Lady Helen Herron Taft plants the first cherry tree in Washington, D.C. 1915, British battle cruisers Inflexible and Irresistible hit mines in the Dardanelles. This day in 1915, the Federal Trade Commission is organized. 1916, with the world going up in flames, U.S. and Canada sign a migratory bird treaty. 1917, Russian Grand Duke Michael, brother of Tsar Nicholas II, declines to take the Russian throne after his brother abdicated. 1920, one-acre park, also known as Baby Park in the Bronx, is renamed Melrose Park. 1921, Britain signs a trade agreement with the USSR and sends a trade mission to Moscow. This is contrary to U.S. policy. That same month, the U.S. refused to sign a trade agreement. 1922, Egypt achieves independence from Britain, but British troops remain in Egypt. 1930, on this date, the USS Constitution, also known as Old Ironsides, was floated out to become a national shrine. 1933, Adolf Hitler names Hjalmar Schacht president of the Bank of Germany. 1939, Hungary annexes the Republic of Carpato, Ukraine. 1940, and there's a German air raid on the British fleet base at Scapa Flow. 1941, a massive blizzard hits North Dakota and Minnesota. 60 people die. 1943, the ships Elin K from Norway and Zanlan from Netherlands are torpedoed by German U-boats and sink. 1944, French Vichy Internal Minister Pierre Pichou sentenced to death for treason. 1947, a Convair liner, the first U.S. twin-engine pressurized airplane, is tested. 1948, Billie Holiday, jazz musician, released from prison early due to good behavior. I don't know why she was in prison, but she was released. See if this tells me. 14, she and her mother were arrested for prostitution following a raid on a brothel in Harlem. 1947, she is arrested in New York for possession of narcotics. And in 1948, released from prison early due to good behavior. So she went to jail for narcotics. 1950 was the first annual National Book Awards. 1955, Josephine Croson, appointed as the first Dutch female judge. 1955, President Eisenhower opposed the use of atomic weapons in case of war. 1962, a U.S. super constellation vanishes over the Pacific Ocean. 167 people are lost in that little situation. Alrighty. Let's see what else. We're going to end our little history segment, move over to our show. You know, there's a lot of very strange things that have happened. Many of which just defy any explanation. And somewhere, this is the problem of using computerized records for my stories. But then again, I can read this and I can't read my handwriting quite often. Everybody is familiar with Napoleon Bonaparte. Born in Corsica, 1769. History says he died in St. Helena, that's an island, in exile in 1821. But like many things, it's not exactly true. Did he really die on the island of St. Helena? Or Helena? And why did the British government issue a conflicting report about his death? A report which was belatedly admitted to be false in one major particular. Napoleon didn't die as advertised. At least that's a lot of evidence supporting that. Now, it is suspected that the man that died on St. Helena was actually poisoned. The lock of his hair was preserved. And when it was examined, it showed arsenic. Now, it's a long, long story, and of course, originated with Napoleon himself. He was one of the first leaders to go to great pains to secure doubles for himself. And he did this many years before his empire began to collapse. Of these doubles, painstakingly gathered by Napoleon's agents from all over Europe, one died of poisoning shortly before Waterloo. Another one was injured in a riding accident and was left disabled, which made him useless as a stand-in for Napoleon. So that left two. One of them was a man named Francis Eugene Robillard, born in 1771 in the village of Ballycourt in the Meuse. Bore such a remarkable resemblance to Napoleon in both face and figure, his fellow soldiers called him the Emperor. And it was inevitable that this similarity be brought to Napoleon's attention, and Private Robillard soon found himself living off the fat of the land. He was a member of Napoleon's personal staff. After the 100 days, while Napoleon waited at Rochefort, his conquerors decided his fate. The 100 days was when he came back from Elba. But one thing the British wanted to make themselves sure of was he had to be exiled to a place where escape wouldn't be impossible. They said there cannot be another Elba where he easily escaped, and there can't be another 100 days of him back on the loose again. So to the sunbaked island of St. Helena he went, and according to the records of the British government, he died there of cancer 6 years after arriving. And during that 6 years, he supposedly was never left alone for a moment. Well, while Napoleon was sitting on that rock off the coast of Africa, his double, Francois Robillard, went back to Ballycourt to resume the life of a farmer. And when Napoleon safely locked up, the French Minister of Police called in the special agent who'd been assigned to watch Robillard's movements. Since Napoleon was of a certainty on the island and couldn't get off, the investigator named Ledru was reassigned to chase tax dodgers. Napoleon lost his freedom, it's true, but he still had a lot of friends, and more importantly, his friends had a lot of money. His key to escape had to be a golden key if it was to turn the lock that kept him on St. Helena. And it was a key that had to be very carefully made because there couldn't be any slip-ups. There could only be one attempt, and it had to succeed. Now, there was some very interesting, apparently unrelated events that took place. In 1818, General Gourgaud left his post of command at St. Helena and was replaced by General Bertrand. And by a very leisurely route, Gourgaud made his way to Paris, where he lived quietly and unostentatiously. His major contacts were with old friends from his years on the battlefield. old friends that included some very wealthy and influential people who had ample funds and a deep friendship with Napoleon. Well, about 2 months after Gourgaud arrived in Paris, a fine coach drew up near the village of Ballycourt to inquire for the home of Francois Ribaud. Neighbors directed the coach to the humble cottage where Ribaud lived with his sister. Nobody saw or admitted seeing the occupant or occupants of the coach, but passers-by later recalled they'd seen the coach itself standing beside the road a few rods from the lane that read the Ribaud's house. It was dark, and the villagers who saw the coach went on about their business. They'd learned through experience they couldn't get any trouble if they didn't ask any questions. Well, Ribaud and his sister went on about their daily routines for a month or so after the appearance of the coach. And who was in the coach? Well, when they were asked, they said a physician wanted to buy some of Ribaud's rabbits as a gift for a friend. Well, one morning in the autumn of 1818, a neighbor on his way to work noticed the door of Ribaud's house was standing ajar. It was raining, and the wind was blowing the rain into the house, and he thought it was odd that Francois would be still in the bed at this late hour and with his door standing open as well. Well, the neighbor went to close the door, and when he got to the open doorway, he glanced inside and didn't see a fire on the hearth, which was odd. So it appeared something was wrong with Francois and his sister. He called out their names and didn't get a reply. Well, interestingly enough, neither Francois nor his sister ever seen in Ballycourt again. They left suddenly in the middle of the night, taking very few of their garments with them. So the question became, did they leave willingly? Well, the sister was seen in Paris 2 years later by two of the Ballycourt merchants whom she pretended not to recognize. Well, they immediately notified the authorities, and Inspector Ledrew, the man who'd been assigned to originally watch Francois, was again assigned to track down the elusive Francois Ribaud. Well, this time he failed. There was no sign of the man. Now, he did locate the sister living very comfortably in Tours. When he questioned her, she's about her change of financial status, she said a physician had taken a fancy to her and was paying all her bills. Well, Mr. Ledrew understood such situations up to a point, but beyond that point, he was left with a head full of question marks. I mean, the friendship that she hinted at between the physician and the homely country girl from Ballycourt wasn't at all impossible. I mean, everyone to their own taste, said the woman that kissed the cow. But if it existed, it had to be one of the most platonic friendships of its kind on record. Because as nearly as Ledrew and his men could determine, Ribaud's sister never even saw the wealthy physician who made the claim of being so enamored with her. The arrangement was purely financial, and by remote control as well. A courier arrived, regular as clockwork, to give her money. Well, desperate for information and worn out by weeks of pointless spying on the country girl, frustrated little inspector finally came out into the open. He approached her and said, "Where's your brother?" And she smiled and said, "He's away on a trip. He decided to become a sailor and went on a long voyage." "Well, what ship's he on?" they asked. She didn't know. "When did he leave?" "Quite a while ago." "When's he going to be back?" Well, she didn't have any idea. She said Francois was always closed-mouthed about his plans and comings and goings. Well, finally, the investigator gave up. Her boat house at Ballycourt was shuttered and deserted, and General Gourgaud lived quietly in retirement, and Ribaud's sister enjoyed fine living at someone else's expenses and tours. Napoleon's double was missing. That's the bottom line. Well, the government immediately checked with General Bertrand on St. Helena and was informed that Napoleon was still there. Well, in order to escape from St. Helena, Napoleon needed three things: a ship, some friends, and some money. If he had the last two, the friends and the money, getting the first one was easy. Well, the boat vanished from his native Ballycourt in early autumn of 1818. By that time, Napoleon had ceased to be of more than a routine interest to the jitterly British, and General Bertrand, who was certainly no hater of Napoleon, had been put in charge of the prisoner. However, that same year, General Bertrand's wife wrote to a friend and said, "Success is ours. Napoleon has left the island." Well, the truth or falsity of that statement has never been determined. But in the closing days of 1818, a well-dressed stranger came to the city of Verona in Italy. According to him, he was a merchant from the north of France. His wife was dead, his children had homes of their own, he was fulfilling a lifelong dream to become a resident of Italy. Well, he proposed to open a small shop, or maybe buy one if the price was right and the requirements were light. Well, the shop he opened bore the sign of an optician, but like most of its kind in those days, it dealt in diamonds. The stranger, called himself Rivard, showed very little interest in either optics or diamonds. He preferred to let his partner, Mr. Petrucci, handle the business side of the affairs. Now, many people thought Rivard bore a striking resemblance to Napoleon, and his acquaintances called him the Emperor. Petrucci often scolded him for giving away merchandise to impoverished couples who couldn't afford to buy what they wanted. Rivard would only laugh and reimburse the till from his own pocket. Well, in the afternoon of August 23rd, 1823, according to the testimony of Petrucci and others, a coach drew up in front of Rivard's little shop, and the coachman ran inside, gave Rivard a letter that upset the man greatly. He turned to Petrucci and said, "I find I have to leave at once on some important matters. I'm going to leave the shop in your hands. Please see the coachman and the horses are properly cared for." 2 hours later, he came back to Petrucci's house and gave him a thick letter written in parchment and sealed with wax in several places. He said, "I have to leave on a long journey, and these are evil times. If I'm back in 3 months, take this letter to the King of France, and he'll repay you for your services." Then Rivard stepped into the waiting coach and vanished into the night. 12 nights later, September 4th, 1823, lights were blazing in Schönbrunn Castle in Austria, while the son of Napoleon was critically ill with scarlet fever. Short before 11 p.m., one of the guards heard a rustling in the vines that spread over the high stone walls around the garden. The shadowy figure dropped to earth and ran toward the castle. The guard, as they had been instructed to do, fired at that figure and it collapsed. When he checked, he found that his target was dead. The body was carried into a gardener's hut and authorities were called. They took one look at the body and ordered the building locked and posted a guard. Next morning, two high Austrian officials who had known Napoleon in life came to view the remains of the mysterious stranger who had been shot to death in the gardens of Schönbrunn Castle. A few hours later, representatives of the French embassy came to claim the body. They didn't keep it, though. At the insistence of Napoleon's wife, the body was returned to the castle and buried in an unmarked grave on a direct line with the spots which later held the remains of his wife and son. As for Rivard, he never did return to his shop in Verona. Before Petrucci could deliver the letter to Paris, as he'd been instructed, a quartet of French officials arrived in Verona, liquidated the shop that had been operated by the mysterious Mr. Rivard, and paid Signor Petrucci 100,000 gold crowns for both the letter and his silence. Petrucci maintained his silence on the subject for 30 years, and then he told his story under oath to the authorities of Verona. He was very confident, he said, that his strange partner had actually been Napoleon Bonaparte. Meanwhile, on sunbaked St. Helena, death came to the prisoner listed as Napoleon. People who knew the emperor and who visited him in his last days reported that the exile had certainly wrought some remarkable changes on the emperor. He didn't seem to be able to recall many of the incidents that should have been well known to him. Rather rude and at times quite uncouth to visitors. The doctors who treated him showed little respect for their distinguished patient, if in fact it was Napoleon. Another unusual angle was added to the case when it came time to examine the will which the prisoner had left and which he had written about a year before he died. handwriting showed numerous and marked differences from that of the real Napoleon, and eminent French authorities who examined the document expressed the opinion that Napoleon had undergone some very pronounced changes, brought on no doubt by his imprisonment. In the town records of Ballycourt, there is inscribed the name of François Eugène Ribaud. Born in this village, died on St. Helena, it says. The date of Ribaud's alleged demise on St. Helena has been obliterated. For in view of the existing evidence, it's not impossible he died there on May 5th, 1821, under the name of Napoleon Bonaparte. Another tantalizing chapter is added to the circumstances surrounding Napoleon's death by the official British disclosure in the spring of 1956. After having closed the book on the emperor in 1821 with the announcement he died of cancer of the stomach, the British waited 125 years to reveal they had a preserved section of Napoleon's intestine, which is plainly perforated. Oddly enough, the injury to the intestine corresponds closely to that which might have been made by either a bayonet or a bullet. Was that the injury that caused Napoleon's death, as the British now assert? Was it inflicted by a gunshot wound suffered in the garden of Schönbrunn Castle? Well, the answers to these questions will go far towards clearing up one of history's most celebrated mysteries. The true story of the death of Napoleon Bonaparte. Well, there are many ways to take life. But what if there was a way to create life? Man may have discovered a way to do that. That man was Andrew Cross. Now, his neighbors regarded him as more devil than man. They didn't understand the bright flashes that lit his laboratory windows at night when he tinkered with his crude electrical devices. Not only was he dreaded and shunned as the thunder and lightning man, but he was denounced as an atheist, a blasphemer, a Frankenstein, who had best be put in chains for the common safety of everybody else. Well, Andrew Cross minded his own business, but his was a very strange business for the first half of the 19th century. And one of his baffling experiences remains strange business to this day. He inherited a well-mortgaged and poorly kept estate in Quantock Hills, and he settled down to the relatively humdrum routine of eking out a living, paying off his inherited debts, and conducting himself in his spare time as an amateur scientist. And this endeavor, he had little connection with others in that same field. He labored under the double handicap of not understanding his own experiments, not knowing about the accomplishments of others. Maybe it was his lack of knowledge that led him into the experience that's sent his name down through history. Pondering around in his ramshackle laboratory, he decided to conduct some experiments on the formation and development of artificial crystals by means of prolonged exposure to weak electrical currents. He rigged up a small chunk of porous stone. It was actually oxide of iron from Mount Vesuvius, and kept it electrified by means of a crude battery. Dunking this arrangement into a solution of hydrochloric acid and silicate of potash, he hoped to create some artificial crystals of silica. Now, what he hoped to do with them is anybody's guess, but he attached the wires to the lumps of iron oxide and set the equipment on a small table where it would be out of the way while he went back to his regular pastime of studying the spark gap, the flashes which alarmed his neighbors. Well, did he accidentally hit upon an arrangement that created life out of inorganic matter? There are those who believe he did. In a paper which he wrote for the London Electrical Society in that same year of 1837, he set down an account of his endeavors. He said, "On the 14th day from the commencement of this experiment, I observed through a small lens a few small whitish excrescences or nipples projecting from about the middle of the electrified stone. On the 18th day, these projections enlarged and stuck out 7 or 8 filaments, each of them longer than the hemisphere on which they grew. On the 26th day, these appearances assumed the form of a perfect insect standing erect on a few bristles that formed its tail. Now, till this period, I had no notion that these appearances were other than an incipient mineral formation. On the 28th day, these little creatures moved their legs. And I have to say now, I was not a little astonished. After a few days, they had detached themselves from the stone and moved about at their own pleasure. In the course of a few weeks, about 100 of them made their appearances on the stone. I examined them with a microscope and observed the smaller ones appeared to have only 6 legs and the larger ones had 8. These insects are pronounced to be of the genus Acarus, but there appears to be a difference of opinion whether they are a known species. Some have asserted they're not. I've never ventured an opinion on the cause of their birth, and for a very good reason. I'm not able to form one. The simplest solution of the problem which occurred to me was that they arose from ova deposited by insects floating in the atmosphere and hatched by electric action. Still, I couldn't imagine that an ovum could shoot out filaments, or that these filaments would become bristles, and moreover, I couldn't detect on the closest examination remains of a shell. I next imagine, as others have done, that they might originate in the water and consequently made a close examination of numbers of vessels filled with the same liquid. And none of these could I find a trace of an insect, nor could I see any in or in any other part of the room. Well, this puzzled amateur scientist was well aware of the tightrope he was walking. He was describing an experience that didn't fit into the accepted patterns of science. So he was inviting ridicule, if not worse. So he had to proceed cautiously. He suspected that the mysterious insects might be stowaways on his porous stone, so he dispensed with the stone entirely and conducted experiments with glass jars filled only with various acids, copper nitrate, copper sulfate, zinc sulfate. Again and again, his little visitors appeared in solutions. He found, as he wrote, that these acara appeared first beneath the surface of the acid, but after once emerging from their acid birthplace, they quickly died if dropped back into it. Well, his detractors, of course, claim fraud. Learned men denounce Cross and his insects as nothing more than humbugs and product of airborne spores or impurities in the fluids themselves. Of course, the first ones to scream fraud never bothered to conduct their own experiments. They couldn't be bothered. They knew it was fraud. Well, Cross had anticipated the critics. He'd already begun a new series of experiments designed to determine whether or not the things he saw were the result of electrical generation and nothing more. He actually boiled his jars, baked some of the apparatus in an oven, filled the receivers over inverted mercury troughs with manufactured oxygen, and superheated his silicate solutions. He took these precautions to ensure the sterility of the materials he was using. And on the 140th day after he sent current into his sealed air-free jars, the mysterious acary appeared as before. He discovered one of the creatures shortly before it slipped from the side of the bub and fell back into the caustic solution where it quickly died. Blamed himself for not remembering once they'd left the acid, they couldn't return to it and still live. Moreover, he had to provide a place for them to survive. In an atmosphere strongly impregnated with deadly chlorine, he produced still more of the creatures. Fully developed, he said, but devoid of life. It floated about in the lethal liquid for 2 years till he finally dismantled the equipment. Well, other scientists conducted similar experiments and, amazingly, produced similar results. There was, however, one noteworthy oddity in connection with their findings. When they used sterile equipment, allowed electric current to flow through the fluids, the mysterious insects always appeared. The weaker the current, the longer was the period required for the appearance of the so-called acary. Also found with identical solutions and the current emitted, there would not be an acary development. By increasing the portion of carbons in the fluids, the number of insects was increased in somewhat similar proportion. Of course, this brought about a furor in the scientific circles of his time over the mystifying developments reported from the laboratory of Andrew Cross. Standing virtually alone and unknown against the tide of calumny, he could only repeat doggedly, and he told the truth. And some of his detractors could readily determine if they had to conduct similar experiments. Well, suddenly, he found a champion whom the critics dared not question. The great Michael Faraday reported to the Royal Institute he also had experienced the development of these little creatures in the course of his experiments. He couldn't decide whether to regard them as having been created in the solution, as having brought back to life by the actions of the current. Now, Cross never made any claims he had created anything, unusual or otherwise. He merely tried to report to his contemporaries what he had seen and the conditions under which these things had transpired. Patiently, he noted the striking similarity between the lifeless mineral crystals and the acri, how each first appeared in the acid solutions as minute white specks. He said each mineral speck enlarges and elongates vertically. So it does with the acris. Then the mineral throws out whitish filaments. So does the acris speck. As far as it's difficult to detect the difference between the incipient mineral and the animal, but as these filaments become more definite in each, and the mineral, they become rigid, shining and transparent six-sided prisms, and the animal, they become soft and waving filaments, and finally are endowed with life and motion. Well, Andrew Cross lived many years after his remarkable announcement of 1837. He was a happy man, pondering away in his laboratory at Quantock, seeking truth and living as he pleased till death came for him July 6, 1855. He died in the same room in which he'd been born. Although he spent his life in the quest for scientific truth, the sole contribution for which Andrew Cross is remembered is the controversy over his acri, unwanted then and unsolved today. Some things are beyond the scope of explanation. You know, we've all heard the expression, the Mounties always get their man. But that's not always true. In the annals of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, there's one strange story of an entire village that vanished. In this particular case, the Mounties didn't only get their man, they didn't even get the women or children. For many years, a tribe of Eskimos had been making camp for the winter at Lake Anjikuni, about 500 miles northwest of the Mountie base at Churchill. Convenient spot for them, near enough to hunting grounds for them to survive, and far enough from civilization they could live as they pleased. And this very isolation may have played a part in their strange fate, whatever that fate might have been. Occasional nomadic trappers visited the Eskimos, this lonely spot, swapped talk, ate caribou, smoked a few pipes of trade tobacco, and swapped furs. And one such visitor was a French-Canadian named Joe LaBelle. Now, he knew the country, and the people liked him. He knew the back of his hand, having roamed that part of the wilderness for more than 40 years. It was in November of 1930. Joe was on his way back to civilization from a moderately successful trapping and trading trip. He changed his course slightly so he could spend a few days with his friends at the lonely outpost on Lake Anjikuni. Well, the first intimation that something was amiss came as he started down the slight slope that led to the village. Instead of the customary uproar from the community's dogs, he was met with silence. According to his report to the Mounties, he stopped at the edge of the little village and shouted a greeting. Didn't get a reply of any kind. He thought that was strange, for these were friendly folk who were always glad to see visitors, especially old friends like Joe LaBelle. Opened a caribou skin flap that served as a door to one of the low side huts and he called out again. Still nothing. Didn't get an answer from the next 10 as well. This was very, very spooky, Mr. LaBelle thought to himself. He subsequently reported to the Mounties he spent about an hour in that deserted village examining the scores of tents and huts for some clue about the strange disappearance of the residents. He found pots of food hanging over cooking fires that had been cold for weeks. One hut was a sealskin garment being made for a child, ivory needles still sticking in the garment where the mother had abruptly ceased her mending. On the beach were three kayaks, including one he knew belonged to the headman. These flimsy craft were battered by wave action on the beach. Evidence had been neglected for a considerable period of time. But the most puzzling bits of evidence he discovered were back in the village. In the village, LaBelle and found the Eskimo's prized rifle standing forlornly, waiting for masters to never return. Now, a rifle is more than a prized possession for these simple folks. It's a life insurance policy. No Eskimo in his right mind has started on an extended trip without his rifle. But here they were, rifles, ammunition, and the Eskimos were gone. And how about their dogs? About 100 yards from the camp, he found seven of them. They'd been tied to the stumps of some scrub trees. All had been dead for some time, and to Joe's practiced eye, it was clear they had died of starvation, which is later confirmed by the examination of Canadian government pathologist. On the other side of the camp, from the spot where the dogs were found, he found another baffling phase of his case. There, the Eskimos had buried some member of their tribe with the customary covering of stones over the grave. Well, but this grave was opened. The body was gone. Procedure that would be unthinkable to Eskimos. The grave rifling had been done by somebody who very carefully stacked the stones in two neat piles. Could not have been the work of animals. Whoever did it left no clues. Well, Joe LaBelle made haste to Churchill, where he repeated his eerie experience to the mounted police. He went with them back to the village, where they found things just as he had described. For reasons unknown, a village of about 30 inhabitants had been deserted in the dead of winter, and for reasons unknown, the Eskimos had abandoned the place so hurriedly they left their clothing, food, and guns behind and left their dogs to starve. And the rifle grave? Well, that just didn't make sense to anybody. Months of investigation among other tribes in the area brought no trace of any member of the band that had lived in the village in Anjikuni. Mounted police finally gave up and filed it away as an unsolved mystery, and it's unsolved to this day. Now, we're getting close to the end of the time for today's show, but I'm going to give you some questions to think about. And the answers are not what you think they might be. First question, who shot Abraham Lincoln? Second question, what actually happened to John Wilkes Booth? And who were the conspirators who carried out this plan? Were they all brought to justice? Well, history gives us answers to these questions, but those are not necessarily the correct answers to the questions, as we shall see when we get to tomorrow's show, when we're going to be discussing in some detail who actually shot Abraham Lincoln. The answer may not be what you think. Well, until tomorrow at this same time, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.